This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today with Twitter, where changes at the employer continue to unfold rapidly. More employees laid off last week, including some from the company's Boston office.
30 seconds left. We're all about to get fired from Twitter.
What's the thing?
I've been here 9 years and 9 months now. Same with you.
Right.
How long are you here?
4 years.
That was Matt Miller, who posted a video referring to his departure from Twitter's Boston office alongside several other employees on November 17th. Now, as of the 18th, the Boston Globe reported that the Boston Twitter workforce, once some 300 strong, had dwindled to a little over 100 employees, as measured by their presence on the company's Slack channel. As of 11 a.m. today, Radio Boston was not able to reach the Boston Twitter office to find out if that number further changed or even confirm that the office doors were open today. So much has been made of the social media implications since Musk took over. What about the leadership implications, and what comes next for users and workers here in the region? Joan Donovan is the research director of the Harvard Kennedy School Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy, and Ari Waldman is a professor of law and computer science at Northeastern University and the faculty director for the university's Center for Law Information and Creativity. Joan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And Ari, thanks for joining us.
Of course. Happy to be here.
So Ari, I'm going to start with you, and this is not a rhetorical question. This is an actual question. Have you ever seen anything like this?
Well, certainly not in my lifetime. I mean, there have been companies and law firms that in response to economic changes have slashed their employee numbers. But this is unique in the sense that you have one of the richest men on the planet, who, by virtue of his lack of understanding of how companies operate or how Twitter operates, is essentially running this company into the ground as a passion project or out of a desire to feed his own ego. It's really hard to understand what the rationale is behind this, and I can't imagine what his investors are thinking.
So, Joan, I'll turn to you, and let me just hit a few headlines for listeners. So, Musk announces that he's going to buy Twitter, then he doesn't want to buy Twitter. Then there's a court case, so then he buys Twitter again. Then he lays off a significant percentage of employees. Then last week he announces that everybody has to come back to work in person, full time. Then he announces on midweek last week, anybody who doesn't want the new Cardcore Vision, take a severance package by Thursday. So lots of disruption, and that's not even focusing on the online platform issues that resulted from all of that, the failed change to verification, et cetera. You wrote a piece back in April basically predicting a lot of this. Has it panned out pretty much the way you thought it would? Worse, better, et cetera?
Worse in some ways, because I think the users don't really know where to go. And it's been this mad scramble trying to figure out, you know, how do you reserve all the work that you've done to build these very important networks for, you know, journalists and celebrities and politicians, because there's nowhere like Twitter on the net. There's just not a healthy replacement for it. In terms of Musk's motivation, though, Musk has been for a very long time now extremely anti-media. And so I was not surprised when he jumped in and made a mess of the blue check verification system right away. Was not surprised that he invited back Trump. I was not surprised with Kanye West's return. The only thing that did surprise me was that he seems to be holding the line at Alex Jones. And it's a very
of
personal
InfoWars.
Of InfoWars. So Alex Jones, who recently has been fined over $1 billion for content that he made about Sandy Hook that was untrue, that attacked the parents, that had significant impacts on their lives and their ability to just carry out their grief and move on with their, well, not move on so much, but, you know, have a normal life. Instead, Alex Jones had made them the center of this enormous conspiracy theory. But this is the one line that Musk is not going to cross, is to let Alex Jones back on. And he's alluded to this very personal story about having lost a child, Musk has, and this is the line for him. You know, the rest of us, I think, wish the line for him was hate, harassment, incitement.
Yeah.
Especially as we mourn the people lost in Colorado Springs this weekend. Hate has, you know, an aftermath.
So let me just set context for a few things that you just said. The Colorado Springs shooting was in a gay nightclub this weekend. President Donald Trump had his Twitter account suspended for inciting acts of violence relating to the January 6th insurrection. Kanye West, now had his account suspended for anti-Semitic speech. So these are the contexts in which you're talking about that. There's so much in here. Ari Waldman, at professor of law and computer science at Northeastern University. Let me turn to you for a second. Let's back up for a second. What if I'm a listener right now who says, listen, I'm not on Twitter. I don't care about Elon Musk. I don't care. People who are engineers in Boston who don't work there anymore are going to get another job. Why should I care? This does have reverberations well beyond people who rely on Twitter, either for community or work. Ari, is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. There are so many reasons why people who are not personally, directly, or pecuniarily affected by this should care. Twitter was a cesspool of harassment and hate, particularly for marginalized populations. But it was also an important way for people to get their information out, for journalists to create community, to seek out experts, to connect in ways that weren't allowed on other platforms. In particular, Twitter was not perfect, again, but definitely more of a home for queer expression, especially since Instagram, Facebook, and other social media platforms disproportionately censored anything related to the LGBTQ community. The other reason why people should care is that there is a direct line between the kind of hate that is now accessible on this rump of Twitter that Elon Musk has created, and the kind, as Joan mentioned, and the kind of violence murder that happened in Colorado, the violence of people throwing Molotov cocktails and bricks through the windows of queer bars that host drag nights or libraries that host drag readings for children. There is a direct line. And it's not enough. And it's not enough for someone to say that, well, I was personally affected by X, and therefore I'm going to draw the line at Alex Jones. The fact that Elon Musk has shown absolutely no empathy, absolutely no interest in the effects of his platform on anyone other than himself and people like him, just shows how broken and bankrupt the Twitter community is going to be, such that now journalists, academics, any people looking for jobs, queer people, marginalized people, those living with disabilities, lots of communities, including justice movements across the world, use Twitter effectively. All of these groups are now without the tools that they have had for the last several years.
So Joan Donovan of the Harvard Kennedy School, as Ari lays that out, he starts moving us really into your wheelhouse in terms of your research of online hate, et cetera. I want to play a little bit of sound from a conversation we had here on Radio Boston last week with Charles Gallagher, who's a professor of history at Boston College. We were talking about his book, Nazis of Copley Square, which looked at the emergence of the Christian Front before World War II. And he talked about the fact that actually, in some ways, the Christian Front was more powerful after it was forced underground. Here he is.
The Christian Front was able to be more insidious and was more in turn exterminationist, which is disturbing, when they were forced underground in 1943. The speech could not be monitored as the organization went underground, and consequently, I think the benefit of free speech is that it can be open to the public and viewable.
Now, I want to be clear, Joan Donovan, free speech as in First Amendment doesn't necessarily apply to a private company owned by one person. But this breeding ground for hate, inability to track it, on the 17th, per NPR on the 17th of November, the first round of cuts at Twitter slashed 15% of their trust and safety employees. That was the first round of cuts. Mm-hmm. So take us to where we might be headed.
Yeah, I don't particularly think that when these infrastructures that allow for hate to spread in such massive volume that you are attracting and recruiting lots of new people to these movements, I don't think it's a bad thing. And our research shows it's not a bad thing if these networks are disrupted in some ways, particularly the networks that do bring resources in. So it's not just that people are communicating on these networks, but as Ari was alluding to, movements, whether they're far right or left wing, they use these tools like Twitter specifically to drive resources and drive people from what our book on meme wars that came out in September alludes to, which is from the wires to the weeds. People are moving from these ideas and these mobilized online and into the streets, and they're doing and behaving in different ways. And, you know, we have all these correlates now between accounts that are against LGBTQ folks and then bomb threats at Boston Children's Hospital, right? There's a lot of anti-trans propaganda flowing through Twitter right now, and it's directly showing up in people's lives. And even if it wasn't producing bomb threats, what else it's producing is that doctors are afraid to provide this kind of care, gender-affirming care now. And so there's a lot going on. And I think, you know, the invitation to bring Trump back to this platform is also in a lot of ways anti-democratic, which is something that when we look much more closely at movements that are anti-establishment, especially the last large manifestation of MAGA that was, you know, an attempt to overthrow the Capitol, that kind of talk online directly incites people to do these large-scale violent actions. And so we might not be looking at this one-to-one correlation between what was going on in the 40s and now, but rather the challenge right now is to figure out, well, what kind of guardrails can regulators put on social media companies so that this doesn't get further and further out of control?
We're talking about the implications of the leadership choices Elon Musk has made since he took over Twitter. We've been speaking with Joan Donovan. We're also talking with Ari Waldman, and the implications and how that will reverberate here as well as elsewhere. So, Ari, I'm going to turn back to you. I'm going to play a little sound from Boston Globe technology writer Hiawatha Bray talking to us on Radio Boston about Twitter last week.
I'm an Elon Musk fan. I don't think there's any question that in 50 years, he's going to be looked at the way we look at Henry Ford or Bill Gates. But that doesn't mean he's perfect, not by any means. He clearly does not know what he's doing at Twitter. It's just been a hot mess.
Ari, I've been intrigued by the leadership dimension of this because people keep saying it's nonsensical, he's messing up. I'm not in his head. From a leadership standpoint, is it possible that he's doing exactly what he wants to be doing? And there is no mess up here happening at all?
Well, if his goal is to ruin the company, that's he's doing exactly what he's doing. He's taking steps that would exactly lead to that. I'm not sure that we want to. And I'm not sure someone who thinks that what Elon Musk is doing is a good thing wants to compare him to Henry Ford, who was a Nazi sympathizer.
Well, I do want to be clear that Hiawatha Bray didn't say what he was doing at Twitter was a good thing. I do want to be clear about that. But go ahead.
Sure. So it's hard to, obviously we're not in his head. I think Joan is right that that he has for a long time been anti-media, but he's not just, what he's doing here is taking all the steps that one would take to dismantle a company step by step, but at the same time also exposing himself to incredible liability. So, you know, if you dismantle the content moderation team, sure, you have protections from Communications Decency Act Section 230, which is a federal law that immunizes platforms from lawsuits associated with the choices you make when you moderate content. But on the other hand, when you dismantle the privacy team, the trust and safety team, the security team, you're setting yourself up for investigations by the FTC, by the DOJ, by other government regulators that are now it's now relatively easy to, would be relatively easy to find out if Twitter is no longer in compliance with consent decrees or no longer in compliance with applicable laws. So if this is something that is, you know, some grand plan of his to run the company into the ground, he's doing so while exposing him and his investors to great liability.
So, Joan Donovan, I'm mindful of a tweet I saw over the weekend from Sue O'Connell, who's at NBC Boston. And it was from a picture that had been posted of Musk and several of the people who had responded to his call to show up at headquarters in San Francisco on Friday. It seems like to do coding. It is in the picture what appears to be an all-male room with him. And O'Connell says, "Don't worry your pretty little heads, ladies. The men who can or must work hardcore have this handled. I'm sure your concerns will be considered." What about representation in a company as powerful as this one?
Yeah, I mean, engineering culture is very different. Obviously, there's many, many pipeline issues educationally with getting women into engineering. Particularly in these highly competitive fields. I was at Twitter about 2 weeks before Musk acquired it, and the mood there was very solemn. I had lunch in the cafeteria with a couple of colleagues, and I had been brought in to talk about my book to the machine learning and ethics team, which was one of the first teams that he disbanded. And I think Twitter, you know, as it changes and as he gets lean and mean with the corporate structure, it's going to show up in the product. The product is not going to have as many guardrails in terms of spam and making sure that people don't see pornography and these kinds of things. But it's also going to get more dangerous, I think, for women as, you know, things that don't go away are things like trolling and brigading and, you know, even Kanye's first tweet, Shalom, that he came back with was meant to troll. So I don't think, you know, we're going to get the best out of this new arrangement.
All right. Joan Donovan is the research director of the Harvard Kennedy School Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy. Ari Waldman is a professor of law and computer science at Northeastern and the faculty director of the university's Center for Law, Information, and Creativity. Appreciate you both helping us sort of clarify the picture here. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Today we bring you kind of a double feature. Two different stories from two different reporters together in this week's From the Newsroom. First up, an investigation into the practice of shuffling police officers from department to department in Massachusetts after they have been fired or forced to resign. And here to break down what's happening, the reporter on this story, WBUR's Walter Wuthman. Welcome back, Walt.
Hey, Tiziana.
So, Walt, listen, how bad is this shuffling around? What did you find in your reporting?
We find that it happens, I think you could say, often. And so the way we tracked this was by filing public records requests with over 100 police departments across the state asking for people who'd been fired or who left while they were being investigated over the last decade. We then cross-referenced those with active rosters of police officers in Massachusetts. And we got a lot of matches. We worked through to try to confirm as many as we could. There's a real lack of public information, but we found that for certain there are more than a dozen current police officers working now that were fired or resigned to avoid some kind of discipline or end an investigation at their former department.
So you used a couple of stories of officers as examples to illustrate that. Maybe give one of those to us here.
One of the most, I think, surprising and illustrative examples, I'd say, is Adam Pecos. He's an officer who was fired for the state police. Police found that he had been caught driving drunk multiple times while off duty. He was intercepted by police officers each time. They didn't arrest him on the scene. There were rumors circulating around the department. Supervisors investigated, and they found that he had driven drunk at least twice, maybe three times. They fired him. He later got a new job in Irving, Massachusetts, which is out in the western part of the state. We got his internal affairs file there, and we found that he'd been arrested for drunk driving again when he was out of state in Seattle. You might think that, okay, that would have ended his career then, but it didn't. He served a brief 5-day suspension, and they later promoted him to sergeant.
And I should ask you, has the officer responded to your reporting?
He has not, no. And we've reached out multiple times through multiple platforms.
Okay, so you introduced us to an expert, Philip Stinson, who's a criminologist at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, who gave you some of the context for your reporting. We actually had a chance to speak with him earlier this morning. So I want to play that discussion. You sit tight, because then we'll come back to you, because I want to ask you some more questions.
Sounds good.
Well, I study police crime, so crime committed by non-federal sworn law enforcement officers across the country. And in my research over the last 18 years or so, we've noticed a phenomenon where officers who get in trouble sometimes end up employed at the same agency. They come back to the same agency, or more often we find them moving from one agency to another. Quite oftentimes it's within the same state. Other times we're surprised to see that officers have moved far away to another state, you know, at the other end of the country. So we call it the officer shuffle. In my research specifically, we only identify the officers who actually have been arrested and then find their way to employment again as a sworn officer somewhere else. But a more common phenomenon, at least anecdotally, from what we've been able to ascertain from talking to people across the country, is that sometimes problem officers who get in trouble over and over again, are given the opportunity to quietly resign from their job as a police officer in one place so as to avoid criminal charges or actually being fired. And those officers seem to have the easiest time with the officer shuffle, moving from agency to agency and taking their problems with them quite often. They're problem officers in one place, and we see it again that they become a problem officer in another place.
So there's a lot there. I want to break down a couple of pieces. First, you said you study officer crime. How prevalent is that? How prevalent is criminal activity by law enforcement officers? You know, however you want to measure it, as a percentage of the police who serve, or however else you might measure that.
Well, it's really difficult. You know, we have probably close to 18,000 state and local law enforcement agencies across the United States. And in my research, we typically identify about 1,200 to 1,300 cases each year where a police officer or deputy sheriff, a state trooper, a game warden has been arrested for one or more crimes. So we have identified since 2005 officers who've been arrested in approximately 5,000 of those agencies across the country. In large agencies, it's often fewer than 2 or 3% of the officers. In small agencies, sometimes we see the majority of the officers in an agency, in a very small agency, sometimes have been arrested.
So you talked, Philip, about this idea that there's the arrest and a shuffle, and then there's given an opportunity to quietly resign without being arrested. Now, I am not naive. I understand that there is always discretion, right, in choices to prosecute, arrest, et cetera. But what allows police departments to choose not to criminally prosecute an officer and let them quietly leave? Is it just because there's no transparency? Is it, you know, can you explain that a little bit for us?
The problem here is that police chiefs often treat these situations as a bad apple problem. If they get rid of one bad apple, if they get rid of two bad apples, they've solved the problem. But it's a bigger issue than that. The way that I look at it, it's really a problem of police legitimacy. If people don't have faith and trust in their local police officers and their local law enforcement agencies, they're not going to want to cooperate with officers when officers need their help. They're not going to want to cooperate with prosecutors when prosecutors need them to come to court to testify. They're not going to even want to call 911 when they actually have an emergency and need some assistance. So it's a huge problem. It's not a problem of a few bad apples. It's a problem of a culture within policing, what I refer to as the police subculture in many of these agencies. But also the heart of the problem is it leads to an erosion of trust in the police. It leads to an erosion of police legitimacy.
So what about the argument that people change? Should a person have to lose their whole career? Now, I understand sometimes you're talking about criminal activity that could lead to arrest. I understand that not all violations are created equally. But should somebody automatically never be able to serve again as a law enforcement officer?
Well, I think that officers need to be afforded due process, whatever that means, in terms of administrative actions that are taken against officers. They ought to be able to have their case heard. They ought to be able to have a hearing, if that's appropriate, before they're terminated, assuming they're not a probationary officer. In other words, an officer perhaps in their first year of employment. Now, some states, there's no continued right to public employment. So in those states, it's easier for agencies to terminate officers without affording them much, if any, due process. But I think that public employees should be afforded some level of due process. However, that goes in administrative context and that goes in criminal context, obviously. However, we have to be able to demand and expect more of our police officers. We don't want to have officers who are problem officers, officers who get in trouble as a matter of routine, officers who are bringing disgrace to the badge. I think that the citizens are entitled to better.
In the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, where Walt Wolfman's reporting has happened, here in 2020, our governor signed a police reform bill. It included a police officer standards and training initiative that would begin to license officers, track this data better. We were one of a handful of states that didn't have that. Does that make a difference? Or if not, what else needs to be done besides better data and licensing and tracking to solve this problem?
It does make a difference. However, we have seen some problems. For example, a case in Florida comes to mind where we actually found an officer who had been arrested in Florida, an officer from Daytona Beach, who to resolve her criminal case, she agreed that she would not work in law enforcement again, and she was to be decertified in Florida. That didn't happen for one reason or another. Just administratively, the system failed and it didn't happen. We found her working again as a deputy sheriff in Richmond, Virginia. Much to the surprise of the authorities in Virginia, she had been prosecuted criminally in Florida several years earlier and was to be decertified. So there are sometimes problems with these systems. However, generally, these are very important systems, and they do slow down the officer shuffle. They keep problem officers from being able to move from place to place. They aren't foolproof, but they certainly go a long way in that regard.
Philip Stinson is a criminologist at Bowling Green State University. Really helpful. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Well, my pleasure.
So returning here to Studio 2 now, as we have this conversation about the moving of officers who are arrested or under investigation, leave one law enforcement agency and then wind up at another, WBUR's Walter Wolfman is still here in Studio 2 and has been reporting on this. I want to start just by getting your reactions to the conversation we just had with Philip Stinson.
He's great. He does really, really cool work, really interesting work all over the country. When I spoke to him for my story, he tracks police crime. So officers that, there's a conviction and they lost their job because of that. That is actually one way to track. There's a public record. What he said, I think he used the term his white whale, and what we are also trying to do with our reporting in Massachusetts is that grayer area where the officer resigns before discipline happens. These sort of agreements, this loophole, and it's very hard to track. The way we did it is by asking these departments, okay, who left while they were being investigated, and then following up individually to figure out what actually happened. But this is a way, it's a very common way that police who are accused of often serious misconduct escape accountability.
So that means a ton of legwork. I'm assuming hours and hours and hours of cross-comparing databases after probably, I'm assuming, weeks and weeks and weeks of trying to get the information. Is that fair, Walt?
Yeah, it's a lot of work. And then there's some we just can't even verify. So Grace Ferguson, who was a BU fellow who did a lot of the work with the initial public records in this.
Boston University fellow here at WBUR.
Yeah, at BUR. Yeah. When she was here, she found there are 11 officers in the state named Michael Murphy. 4 of them work for the state police. We have no way to track from the outside which Michael Murphys are moving between which departments. So we just let that be. We're not going to touch that. But the Post Commission, who Phil Stinson was talking about, this new licensing board, they have access to social security numbers, birthdays, addresses, where they can uniquely identify which Michael Murphy is which, and track who's moving between departments. So when they eventually publish their data, which they're supposed to do, we will have a much better idea of how often these officers are moving between departments.
So you said post, that's that police officer standards and training, a commission which was put in place in the 2020 police reform law that Governor Baker signed. When do you know, when were they or are they supposed to put that information out?
They were supposed to publish it last spring.
Spring 2022 or spring 2021? This past spring.
This past spring.
Yeah, I'm throwing dates at you like crazy.
they were supposed to publish it last spring. We've asked many times, okay, what is your new deadline? What is your new deadline? And they won't say. They don't want to set a deadline for themselves because this work is so complicated. They're getting the same barrage of data and even more than we were able to. It's all coming in different forms. There are some departments that are sending incomplete records, incomplete discipline. So they are weeding through a lot of material, and they will not set a deadline. They won't publicly say when all of this will be available.
So I asked you earlier in our conversation, Walt Withman, who, you know, WBUR General Assignment Reporter here, whether you had a response from either of the specific police officers that you named with their instances as illustrations in your story. What about from police departments, state police, other law enforcement agencies around the state? Have they commented? Have you received cooperation, pushback? I mean, this story is beginning to take on national attention. It's now posted in the Globe online. It'll be in the print edition tomorrow. What are you hearing?
It's been very hard to get any departments to talk to us, which I think kind of exemplifies this cultural silence. So in Blackstone, which was another case we looked at, there was this officer who was accused of sexually harassing and assaulting a student at UMass Dartmouth.
When he was a university campus officer.
He resigned before that investigation concluded. He later found work in Blackstone, which is a town south of here on the Rhode Island border. And they made him a school resource officer. They put him in the high school, and he's a sexual assault investigator for the town, which seemed odd given his past allegations. So we brought these records to the town. We asked them for comment, and the town administrator said, I was unaware of this. I did not know about this, and I'm concerned about what you're telling us. So apparently they have removed him from the schools, and they've started an investigation of their own. But he is still an active officer in Blackstone, and we may be hearing more from them as this reporting goes on.
So what else are you going to follow now, Walt? What's the next question?
I would really like to see all the data that the Post Commission has. We've tried to get access to parts of it. You know, we've asked if they could do their own analysis of saying, okay, looking at officers with different employment records, with different allegations against us, can you give us a raw number of how many officers have been fired or resigned to avoid, discipline and moved on to a new place? They've declined to give us even that. So we will keep asking, and when that data comes out, we're going to have a much better idea of the scope of this problem.
All right. WBUR reporter Walter Withman, who's been following the shuffling of police officers in Massachusetts who leave one department under investigation or arrest and then wind up somewhere else. Walt, thanks for your reporting and for talking to us about it today.
Thank you.
When we return, another story from the newsroom, this time about hidden fees and title insurance. Now, don't start snoozing because it's insurance, because it turns out this really matters for you if you ever want to buy a house. I'm Tiziana Deering. You are listening to Radio Boston. Now, if you have bought a home or are in the process of buying one, and if it's in the process first, just God love you, then you have probably heard or paid for title insurance. That's what protects your bank lender and you if you choose to buy a policy to protect yourself if someone challenges your property title for whatever reason. We'll explain that a little bit more. But it turns out that a lot of what you pay in that line item doesn't necessarily pay for the insurance. It could go to fees that you probably can't see. This isn't surprising, considering that title insurance is drastically under-regulated in Massachusetts compared to some other states. And our second from the newsroom today, because we're giving you a box set, we take a look at this Wild West market and what it could mean for homebuyers. With us now, Beth Healy, WBUR investigative reporter and following the story, and Peter Ott, new homebuyer, and insurance actuary. Beth, welcome back.
Thank you.
Peter, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Great to have you both. So, Beth, I'm going to start with you. Tell us what you found.
So, first, Tiziana, a title is the thing that gives you the right to own your property, and it has to be checked out before you get to buy your house. But what we found is that there's this multi-billion dollar industry, almost completely unregulated in Massachusetts, and you're paying thousands of dollars for this thing, for these, usually people are buying the two policies, and your lawyer is getting 80% of the money, but they don't have to tell you that.
So let me ask you something, Beth. So the title you have to have, the insurance is to protect you or the lender should it turn out that somebody can say, no, this house doesn't really belong to you. Is that basically what the insurance is?
That's right. And the idea is that your real estate lawyer is supposed to be helping you check all this stuff out before you buy the house. Nothing's supposed to go wrong. Actually, it's very rare after you buy your house that things do go wrong. But what happens is you have to buy the insurance for the bank. You're required to buy it for them so they don't lose their money if something were to go wrong later. And then you have an option to buy it for yourself, and the lawyer will really try to persuade you to buy it.
Okay. So tell me about these fees. How much of that? So what a title insurance policy cost, and what did you find about where that money was going?
So it ends up costing, it depends on the cost of your house. So the more expensive your house, Massachusetts, the median is over 700 grand, as we all know. It's painful. So you're going to pay, you know, around $4,000 or more in many cases for this insurance. And what we were able to determine is that, you know, Peter can tell you more about this, but you would think, gosh, do they pay a lot of claims on this insurance since it costs so much? No, it turns out less than 3% of the money ever goes to pay for bad claims. So all that money is going to your lawyer.
So the lawyer actually gets the majority of that money.
Correct.
All right, so Peter Ott, you're an insurance professional. You're a new home buyer. So person who knows the industry and is now, you know, intrepidly trying in this Boston housing market to purchase a home. So what happens that makes you say, now, wait a minute?
Yeah, so I think it comes down to, I don't know, maybe being just an insurance nerd at heart, being an actuary. And I, as Beth had kind of talked about before, I had never seen this product in my professional career. And so when I saw it, when my partner and I were buying our first home, I said, why haven't I seen this thing? How does this thing work? As I said, how do they model the losses? How do they come up with how much this should cost? And as I went down this rabbit hole, digging around various actuarial papers and financial statements, I realized, most of my premium is actually not going to paying claims. It's going to pay my attorney.
And can you share numbers from your situation with us, or at least order of magnitude?
Yeah, so I think it was roughly a little over $4,800 was paid in total for the title insurance. So 80% of that going back to my attorney as commission.
Did you ask your attorney?
So I ended up asking afterward, and this is how I found out the numbers. But this is what I discovered, I guess, during my research, trying to figure out, where does all the premium come from, and what is it paying for?
So, Beth Healy, I'll come back to you now. And we're talking about this kind of murky world of title insurance. We are less regulated here in the Commonwealth than other places, correct?
We are. It turns out that it's pretty lightly regulated nationally. And this is one of these things that gets regulated state by state. So it's a real patchwork. But in Massachusetts, we are particularly, almost entirely unregulated. They make sure these companies are financially solvent, but they don't review rates. They don't make them public. Literally, the website of the state says, you know, read your policy because we don't review any of this.
All right. So, and I want to make sure for people who may still, I mean, this is a complicated process, right?
Yes.
In the middle of, Peter, a super complicated process, which is purchasing a home.
Yep.
All right. So what we have here in the Commonwealth is the need to purchase the title insurance. You will purchase at least one policy, which is for a lender if the lender is involved. You will be encouraged to purchase a policy to cover yourself as well. The lawyer who is involved, and in Massachusetts, as I understand it, Beth, we have to have an attorney involved in the transaction.
That's right.
Represents you and the title company and brokers this transaction. Is that correct?
That's pretty much the state of things, yes.
Okay. And then, Peter, what you found was, okay, but most of the cost and the money that you pay for the title insurance, when you dug around in your own, spoke to your attorney, et cetera, turned out most of it wasn't going to the insurance. It was going to this brokering.
That's correct.
Function. All right. And Beth, then you found out, and it turns out there's not much paying out of title insurance claims once they're done.
Exactly. It's actually very rare that they have to pay these claims out afterwards. I will say what a lawyer will tell you, like we checked in with the Boston Bar, they say, hey, you know, we actually do a bunch of work for you in checking your title. And that could range from a few hours to, in some complicated homes, maybe a lot. But the problem is all their money is getting tucked into the insurance. Like perhaps it would be fairer to just say, hey, I did 3 hours of work for you.
Okay, so that's a key piece of this. And Beth, I had said to you before the break that actually in a transaction my husband and I, at one point when we were prepared to buy a house, our attorney did find a problem with the title and we wound up not purchasing that house. So there is work that the attorney does. The question is it transparent, Peter? Do you know, okay, my attorney charges this much an hour, this transaction took this much work, therefore I'm paying them that, and then my insurance is this. Now, the whole thing may total $4,000, but then you know what you're dealing with.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think the key piece here is that because of how it's unregulated within the state, it's basically a fixed rate based off of the value of your home. So in essence, the cost is only dependent in terms of the premium you're paying on the value of the home. But you would think that the premium you'd pay if they're trying to determine the complexities of the title would be commensurate with that complexity. So I assume there are some very complicated titles in the state of Massachusetts that would require more work. But right now, it's purely based off of the value of your home.
So not even lined up with the work itself.
Correct.
Beth, did you also try to reach out to Peter's lawyer or the title insurance company? And in general, how did you do as you were researching this in terms of getting responses from attorneys and insurance companies?
Yeah, so it's a world I had not dipped into before we met Peter. And we got very little response from, you know, Peter's attorney only would respond to us in email. She would not be interviewed. The title insurance company, there's a handful of big ones. This particular one, Old Republic, doesn't answer the phone, doesn't respond to reporters' questions. These are publicly traded companies making billions of dollars, and obviously they've been without scrutiny for so long, they don't feel that they need to respond.
So that's something that I was interested in reading your story, Beth. And Beth Healy is a WBUR investigative reporter who's been looking at the pretty unregulated world of title insurance and how it affects home buyers and homeowners here in Massachusetts. You know, I've talked with you about a number of things over the years. What worried you, right? I mean, somebody might say, okay, but in the overall scheme of things, you said medium home price in Massachusetts now above $700,000. If we're looking at $4,000 or $5,000 in the overall scheme of things, it's a small percentage of the transaction. Why are you concerned that it's so untransparent?
Well, I think anyone who's bought a home and anybody listening who hasn't yet, you'll experience this someday. You are literally sitting in that office, signing a stack of papers. You're kind of nervous. You're trying to get this deal done. And the lawyer's like, you got to buy this title insurance and you should really buy this other title insurance. And as I've said to other people, it feels like when I bring a car into the shop and they tell me I need something and I'm like, oh okay, you know, I have no idea.
How do I know?
Exactly. So what we're hoping maybe by bringing this to light is that you'll have the knowledge. You know, you could actually say to your lawyer now, okay, so you think I should get both of those. Can you just disclose for me how much you're getting paid? Then you can add up those fees to all the other fees and at least you'll feel like you're going in with information.
So Peter, as soon as Beth said car, right? I mean, and again, I've had the fortunate ability to purchase a home. I've also owned probably more cars than I should have that have had to go into the shop. I get that idea of vulnerability. So you are quite interesting in that you sit on two sides of this, right? You are in the insurance world, which often will make people agitated and angry because they're not really sure how much am I paying and do you really have my best interests at heart? And now you're a vulnerable home buyer too. If you could kind of wave your fountain pen and have this all work the way you feel like it should with your unique understanding of multiple industries here, how would you have liked your house transaction to go down? What kind of conversation would you have liked to have had with your attorney? What would you have liked to have known? And what do you think would be in the best interests of insurance customers?
Yeah, I think from a consumer financial literacy aspect, I think it's important, as Beth said, just to know what you're getting into. And I think if I could wave my fountain pen or magic wand and change what's happening in the state, I would have liked my conversation to be more of, hey, here's the home that you're looking to purchase. Given its history, here's the complexities that we foresee or don't foresee in the title. And so, you know what? In order to represent you, it's going to cost X amount, and this covers my entire fee for representing you, for searching the title, et cetera, et cetera. But I would hope that there's this idea of transferring risk and paying for the risk that is commensurate with what you're trying to purchase in the home. And so I think that's what I would ultimately want, is just this honest conversation about the risk that you're actually trying to get help with from the lawyer, and knowing how much is that really going to cost them, and how complex is this title that you're looking to transfer.
So in listening to you, Peter, excuse me, I'm a little hoarse in this segment. Sorry about that. One thing that strikes me is, all right, so let's say that I'm making up these numbers for illustration. All right, your title is going to cost $1,000 because it's just not a risky title. Your title insurance is going to cost $50,000 because this is a really risky title. That would actually also help me be a more informed buyer in terms of how complicated is this home? Do I feel safe that I can own it long term? Is there some chance that the lender is going to come back at me and say, we've got a problem? So actually, it would create a more informed owner, period.
Absolutely. I mean, it kind of reminded me of my home inspection process, right? It's now a conversation you can have with the seller and other parties to know exactly what you're getting into and how much it's going to cost to purchase that home.
So, Beth Healy, was there anything that particularly surprised you? I mean, you're no stranger to investigations. You do all kinds. Anything that particularly surprised you as a reporter in digging into this one?
Well, one thing was the lack of response from the insurance companies was quite something. But another thing we found out that took a bit of digging is that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in Washington, they tried to simplify mortgage forms, which we all know there's nothing simple about them, after the financial crisis, 2008, 2009. And one of the things they did was remove the line from the federal mortgage form where the title agent and lawyer used to have to disclose how much money they made.
Interesting.
So this may have been an unintended consequence, and that is one federal fix that someone could do.
And if I understand you correctly, Beth, if that federal fix, those lines were put back in the federal forms, then regardless of how well regulated it was in any given state, you'd know. Because
exactly.
It's in the, now you'd still, Peter, have to sit down and actually read your 52,000 forms
exactly.
At closing, but you might actually be able to do that.
Exactly.
And do you think that would have solved the problem for you and your partner?
I mean, I think short answer, probably not. Because I think in the state of Massachusetts, we're still kind of in this unregulated stance where no matter what lawyer I went to, I probably would have had the same experience. And so I think there's still work to be done other than the disclosure side, but I think it's a good first step.
And are you happy in your house?
Love it.
All right. Very good. Peter Ott is a new home buyer and an insurance actuary. And Beth Healy, WBUR investigative reporter, talking to us about kind of the wild and woolly world of title insurance and fees here in Massachusetts. Beth, thank you.
Thank you.
Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, and Sydney Bowles, with Bart Tachi and Andrea Perdomo Hernandez. We also had help today from Rob Lane. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Titus Folladoon is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for starting your week with us. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.